This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast, giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is Episode 91, Shelley Ebony Ward, Part 1. On November 3, 2007, first responders to a home in Hawk's Nest, New South Wales, Australia, were shocked and horrified by what they found. On a mattress in a feces-covered bedroom with a boarded-over window lay the twisted, emaciated form of 7-year-old Shelley Ward, who had been deprived of food, water, sunlight, medical attention, and basic human decency for months, if not years. Shelley's parents, Blakely and Sharon Ward, were charged with her murder. This is the story of the catastrophic failure of multiple government agencies created to protect Australia's most vulnerable children. It's also the story of the long, torturous death of an autistic 7-year-old girl who spent her final months imprisoned in her dark, filthy bedroom and who is largely known across Australia as Ebony, the girl who suffered the country's worst child neglect death. This is part one of the tragic story of Shelley Ebony Ward. Before I dig into Shelley's story, I'd like to give shout-outs to my newest patrons, Evelyn H. from Northport, New York, and Christy Ann K. from Woodstock, Georgia. Thank you both so much for your pledges, and thank you to all of my patrons for your support. You're helping me get closer and closer to my goal of devoting myself full-time permanently to Suffer the Little Children, and I can't thank you enough. If you'd like to make a monthly or annual pledge, you can visit patreon.com/stlcpod. Thank you all so much. One more quick note before I begin. Another shout-out goes to the anonymous Tumblr user who sent me a link to a story about the unnamed Australian girl, which piqued my interest so much that I ended up covering her story immediately. In older articles from around the time of Shelley's death, she and her parents were frequently identified by name by the media. Later on, due to a law unique to the Australian state of New South Wales, the parents were only identified by their initials, and Shelley herself by her middle name, Ebony. I'm going to be referring to this little girl by her name, Shelley Ward, throughout the episode. She was stripped of everything during her life, and her name after her death, and while I'm helping to give her voice back, I think it's high time Shelley got her name back as well. Blakely Ward was born in 1961. Blake dropped out of high school in year 11 and went to work for his father, but that arrangement ended after Blake's father was arrested for fraud while Blake was a teenager. From that point forward, Blake's income consisted mainly of a disability pension due to what he claimed was an addiction to Valium since he was about 18 years old. In 1990, 29-year-old Blake met a 17-year-old girl named Sharon at a particularly vulnerable time in her life when her parents' marriage was disintegrating. In the midst of the chaos of her life, Sharon felt safe with Blake, and the couple married in May of 1992 when Blake was 32 and Sharon was 18. When they were married, Sharon was pregnant with the couple's first child. Very quickly after their marriage, Blake showed Sharon his true colors. He suffered from severe chronic anxiety, panic disorder, and agoraphobia, which he claimed was the reason for his Valium addiction. He had never had a job. By then, they both survived on sickness benefits, which in Australia is similar to what we call disability in the United States. He was severely controlling, right down to the most minute detail. He taught Sharon how to drive, but forbade her from leaving the driveway. He controlled Sharon's every move, isolating them from their respective families, and he controlled every penny of the couple's finances. Sharon attempted suicide even before their first anniversary. While pregnant with the couple's first child, Sharon was assessed and found to have suicidal tendencies and relationship problems. During this time, the couple applied to the Department of Housing for priority public housing and were accepted. They were placed in a home on Beecham Road in Matraville, a suburb in southeastern Sydney, where they would remain until August of 2007. Their first daughter, who I'll call CW, was born on September 15, 1992. A second daughter, who I'll call TW, was born to the Wards in 1994. In 1993, beginning when their oldest daughter was 8 months old, the Department of Community Services, or DOCS, received its first three reports about the Ward family. All three were investigated and determined to be unsubstantiated, and the Wards managed to stay off DOCS's radar for the next 6 years. Blake and Sharon evidently had trouble handling their two older daughters from the start. In 1998, the two girls were diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, and the younger of the two was also diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. The two girls were prescribed medication to better help their parents manage their behavior. In 1999, Blake met with staff at the primary school the older girl attended, where he acknowledged that the girl and her younger sister were both medicated for their ADHD to control their behavior outside of school. In March of 2000, the DOCS received a report from the school regarding bruising around the younger girl's eye. The same month, on March 22, 2000, the Wards welcomed their third daughter, Shelley Ebony Ward, into the world. The baby was small at birth, weighing just 2.9 kilograms or 6.4 pounds, and even in early infancy, she failed to thrive, although medical professionals were stumped as to the cause. She also failed to meet her expected developmental milestones. She only started crawling at 15 months, and by the time she was 22 months old, she still had not begun walking. Within 2 months of Shelley's birth, the two older girls were transferred to a different primary school, where in June, a letter was sent to Blake and Sharon concerning the girls' frequent absenteeism and the parents' failure to attend two scheduled meetings with school staff. At that point, the family was assigned a homeschool liaison, who made a home visit in August of 2000. In October of that year, the school principal reported to DOCS that both older girls had poor school attendance, mentioning the impact it had on the girls. Blake met with school staff that month and agreed to work with the school to improve his daughter's attendance. The same year, the Department of Education and Training, or DET, reported to DOCS about the two older girls' frequent absences from school. They also reported concerns about Blake and Sharon's use of medication to control the girls' supposed uncontrollable behavior, even though teachers unfailingly reported the girls were quiet and well-behaved in class. Concerns were also raised about possible physical neglect. All of these concerns would be a running theme throughout various reports made to DOCS between 1998 and 2005. DET staff also documented concerns about Blake's abusive, intimidating behavior, as well as Sharon's frequent but unsubstantiated claims that her children were bullied at school. In December, a DET district superintendent wrote to Sharon and Blake, informing them of their legal obligations and scheduling a conciliation conference, which is similar to what we would call mediation, between the parents and the school. Blake said he was out of state and could not attend, but when the DET made a home visit, a neighbor told them the Ward family was at home. The DET rescheduled the conference twice more, but Blake continued to evade them, and a senior DET official advised that the case should be considered for prosecution. When Blake and Sharon again failed to attend meetings scheduled in May and June of 2001, another report was made to DOCS regarding the girls' school attendance. A DOCS caseworker was assigned to assess the family's risk, but the Wards had clearly been practicing the art of evasion. According to an official report, almost from the outset, the DOCS caseworker experienced significant difficulties working with the parents. They would not answer the phone, failed to attend the children's medical appointments, and would not allow the caseworker to lay eyes on Shelley. Despite the involvement of DOCS, Shelley's older sisters continued to miss school, and in January of 2002, due to Blake and Sharon's unwillingness to engage with any support services they were offered, DOCS set in motion court proceedings regarding the children's care and custody. In March of 2002, the Wards welcomed their fourth daughter, who I'll call BW, and in May, the children's court ordered the family to be supervised by DOCS for 9 months. As part of this order, Blake and Sharon had to agree to certain conditions, which included their agreement to ensure their daughter's attendance at school and to ensure the girls received appropriate medical assessment and treatment. Unsurprisingly, very quickly, it became apparent that Sharon and Blake had no interest in complying with the conditions of the court. In June, DOCS applied for an emergency care and protection order, removing BW from Blake and Sharon's custody due to medical concerns that she was failing to thrive. In October of 2002, the older girls were transferred to yet another primary school. Shelley continued missing her developmental milestones. At 34 months old, her functioning was assessed as that of a 13 to 16-month-old child. In January of 2003, when Shelley was almost three, a pediatrician at the Sydney Children's Hospital diagnosed her with moderate global developmental delay, after which the Department of Aging, Disability, and Home Care became involved with the family in order to provide them with speech and occupational therapy. However, Sharon told the agency they already had services in place for Shelley, declining any additional services. Having already removed the fourth child, the agency planned to remove the three older girls from the Ward family's care as well. Shelley, in particular, had been diagnosed with failure to thrive and global developmental delays and was described by a children's court clinician as an extremely worrying child. However, before the girls could be removed, the parents' cooperation began to improve, and in December of 2002, the children's court ordered that the three oldest girls would remain with Blake and Sharon and that the family would remain under DOCS supervision until February of 2003. In August of 2003, the girls' school sent the wards a letter informing them that since kindergarten, their oldest daughter had missed a total of 2.6 years, or 522 days of school, and their second child had missed 2.4 years, or 484 days. This, the school said, was causing the children to struggle academically, and the family was placed back into the home-school liaison program. The agency had begun making plans to return the couple's fourth child, BW. In October of 2003, however, because Blake and Sharon refused to take responsibility for the baby's failure to thrive and stopped visiting her, BW was ordered to remain under the parental responsibility of the minister in what we would call foster care until she turned 18. For the next couple of years, the family again flew under DOCS radar, other than a single report from a concerned acquaintance of the family, although this report was considered hearsay and deemed not to be worth assessment. The older girls' school attendance improved until it again became a concern for the DET in late 2003. In June of 2004, the oldest child, CW, missed 17 days out of 36. And in August, the school wrote another letter to Blake and Sharon, telling them their daughter's attendance rate for the year was 48%. The family was referred yet again to the home school liaison program. From 2003 through 2005, Sharon took Shelley to a variety of doctors about the little girl's failure to thrive, including her short stature and low weight. By mid-2004, Shelley's weight had increased to the point that one pediatrician described her as overweight. A doctor in March of 2005 described her as a well-nourished girl and in the 75th percentile for weight, while yet another described her in December of 2005 as slightly obese. Noted in the records from all of the medical professionals were Sharon's reports of difficulties managing Shelley's behavior, which reportedly included smashing things, compulsively touching objects, and running around the room babbling. I think it's important to mention here that according to childwelfare.gov,
children with disabilities are at least three times more likely to be abused or neglected than their peers without disabilities, and they are more likely to be seriously injured or harmed by maltreatment. Children with disabilities that affect conduct, such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, may be vulnerable to physical abuse by parents or caregivers who may become frustrated by their behavior.
A 1997 study by Benjamin DeHaan of fatal and potentially fatal child maltreatment suggested that children with disabilities could be much more likely to die due to maltreatment than other children who experienced maltreatment. While many children experienced severe abuse, the study found that 40 out of 42 children who died from maltreatment, or 95%, had been previously diagnosed with disabilities or related conditions. Kids with disabilities make up about 10 to 15% of the general population, so one can infer from this study that they may be approximately six times more likely than non-disabled children to die from abuse or neglect at the hands of their parents or caregivers. The implications of that inference are horrifying. In 2005, CW began attending high school, where staff noted information provided to them by a DET official that Blake had a serious personality disorder, that his family was afraid of him, that he had intimidated DOCS staff, that Sharon had been self-harming, that the couple's fourth child was removed, and that DOCS had closed the family's case. That year, DOCS became involved with the family again amidst 6 new harm reports regarding the 3 children in their custody. School staff made 4 of the reports based on the 2 older girls' poor attendance. One of the reports was made by a medical professional concerned about Blake and Sharon's ability to cope with Shelley's behavior. The other report came from someone who was concerned about the children, but none of the 6 reports evidently warranted a risk assessment. In April of 2005, a pediatrician who did not formally assess Shelley diagnosed her nonetheless with autism on the basis of Sharon's description of behavioral problems. The family was referred again to the DADHC by a pediatrician who noted in the referral that the 5-year-old came from a
dysfunctional family that are chronic non-attendees for appointments. DOCS have been involved with the family, and the youngest child is now living with a foster family. Mom has a past history of dependence on painkillers. DOCS is not involved with Shelley. The pediatrician is considering a notification.
Although Sharon requested the doctor prescribe Shelley dexamphetamine to control her behavior, he refused. She was, however, prescribed medication for her diagnosed conditions. The wards were offered various DADHC support services for Shelley, including behavior intervention and speech pathology, which Sharon initially accepted but ultimately withdrew Shelley from, saying she had not seen any improvement in her daughter's behavior. At the time, Shelley was attending a government-run preschool, but in June of 2005, alleging ongoing bullying, Blake and Sharon removed their 2 older daughters from their respective schools and Shelley from preschool. When pulling their children out of school, the wards informed the school in writing that the family had plans to move. Instead, they remained at their public housing address on Beecham Road and simply refused to allow their children to attend school. The oldest girl's high school reported her absenteeism in June, August, and November of 2005. The second girl's primary school made similar reports in May, August, and November. DET files indicate that
DOCS will not be taking action.
In December of 2005, Shelley was assessed and observed to have limited communication. The report indicated Shelley's need for speech pathology, occupational therapy, physiotherapy, and case management services, recommending these services take place in a school setting. According to reports,
the assessment noted that Shelley had a lovely smile, would soon be 6, and would be best suited to attending school.
After the assessment, the DET notified the DADHC case manager that Shelley had been offered placement at a special school for the 2006 school year, where she would receive the services recommended at December's assessment. In April of 2006, the wards accepted this offer, but they never enrolled Shelley, and she never again attended any type of school. The DADHC made a risk of harm report to DOCS in May of 2006 about Shelley's failure to attend school, at which point the DADHC, citing the parents' failure to engage, just closed its file on Shelley, apparently leaving all matters regarding the little girl in DOCS's hands. The DADHC's file notes that during a home visit, the caseworker noted
there was lots of rubbish in backyard,
that no one answered the door, and that the family was
notorious for not responding.
Although Shelley was missing out on important support, the DADHC stressed that its services were strictly voluntary. In February of 2006, Dr. Stamatios Katinas, a general practitioner who last saw Shelley in September of 2003 and remembered her as underweight, saw Shelley during an examination preceding a hernia repair surgery for the little girl. Dr. Katinas noticed that Shelley had become
quite a chubby 6-year-old.
On March 27, 2006, when he gave her the vaccinations she required before beginning school, she looked as healthy as she did the month before. It is believed that was the last time Shelley was ever seen by a doctor. In early 2006, neighbors remember seeing Shelley outside the house in a pusher or stroller, which they found odd because she was 5 years old. She looked healthy, however, and was described as a pretty, even chubby little girl with red hair and a big smile. According to former neighbors, the ward family was
reclusive, antisocial, and nocturnal.
The family seemed active only after 11 p.m. when random visitors would come and go and the 2 older girls would play outside, riding their scooters up and down the street in the dark, wearing shabby clothing, usually shorts and flip-flop sandals, even in the winter. Blake, who was known to wash and polish cars on the weekends, had a severe gambling addiction and spent a lot of time down at the local TAB, which is basically a betting shop. Local shop owners reported seeing the couple shopping together. Sharon, they said, would fill her trolley or shopping cart with food, but Blake would force her to put it all back. At the bakery, he only bought pastries for 4 people, even though there were 5 members of his household. Butcher Jake Kitchen said Blake often visited the Mayall Gourmet Meats butchery, inquiring about cuts of meat, although he never purchased a thing. He said Blake told him he had moved to Hawk's Nest from King's Cross to get away from drugs, but he never mentioned having children. Mr. Kitchen said,
"Usually when he went shopping, you would see him come out with a trolley with 3 or 4 of those 24 Coca-Cola packs. He told me that he used to run a couple of nightclubs down in the Cross, and that before that, he used to be a roadie for AC/DC and a couple of other bands."
In August of 2006, Sharon obtained a medical certificate from a doctor excusing Shelley from attending school for the rest of the year, using Shelley's global developmental delay as the reason. Throughout 2006, DOCS continued receiving reports from the DET about possible harm to the ward children, including reports about frequent absences from school for the older girls and no school enrollment whatsoever for Shelley. The reports also included concerns about Sharon's poor health, Blake's alleged drug use, and alleged domestic violence in the home. Over the years, Sharon's mental health issues had worsened. She suffered from anxiety, depression, and chronic back pain resulting from a fall during her 3rd pregnancy, after which she became addicted to prescription drugs. By 2006, according to witnesses, the woman appeared
thin and pale.
Sharon would later report that from 2005 through 2007, her daily drug intake included 8 to 10 Panamax, 2 to 6 Voltaren Rapid, and 8 to 12 Panadine Forte, all painkillers, in addition to 6 to 15 Valium, all of which made her feel as if
I wasn't really there, felt spacey and dreamlike, as if things were not real.
During this time, a tradesman visited the house and noticed a rope connecting the doorknobs of 2 bedrooms, preventing the doors from opening. Blake told him his autistic daughter was asleep in one of the rooms. One neighbor, Janice Reed, later said she frequently saw Shelley in the window of her bedroom, sometimes naked or wearing only
grubby underwear,
often calling in vain for her mommy and daddy. Eventually, Janice said, the window was boarded up and she could no longer see Shelley, although she could hear her moving around in her room. In early 2007, when Janice stopped hearing Shelley moving around, she and another woman, Debbie Jacobson, contacted state agencies and told them,
"If you don't do something about this child, she will be dead. And if she dies, I am holding you and DOCS responsible for her death."
The women were told that action was already being taken. The wards remained elusive throughout early 2007, failing to attend meetings with the school, the homeschool liaison, and others. By this time, Blake was spending almost all of the couple's combined $900 weekly welfare payments gambling on the internet, and when he wasn't gambling, he lounged on the couch in a Valium-induced daze. At some point, Sharon wrote a letter to her estranged mother, telling her Blake was to blame for their long-term estrangement.
15 years nearly, married that is. I still can't believe I'm alive, really.
She said she wished her mother could have a role in her daughter's lives, especially Shelley, who the woman had spent no significant time with. Sharon also wrote of wishing she could see her mother, but because of Blake's militant rules,
we know that can't happen.
In January of that year, a DOH client service officer visited the family's house to inspect the external eaves and noted the premises were
in an appalling state.
When the officer asked Blake how he cooked because the stove appeared unusable, Blake replied that the stove hadn't worked in 2 years, and furthermore, the kitchen taps did not provide water. The following day, the acting DOH team leader requested a property inspection to be arranged. In late January, a contractor was sent to install a new stove at the ward's house, but due to pests and the overwhelming smell in the home, the contractor declined to work there, citing occupational and safety grounds. At this point, the Department of Housing was notified, and after a specialist DOH worker took over the case, she notified DOCS as well. Her report was allocated for risk assessment, and the DOH specialist supervised the family's case until she was satisfied the home had been cleaned. Around this time, Blake told a DOH client service officer that Sharon was being treated for cancer, using this as his reason not to commit to a necessary client service visit. It's unknown if Sharon actually suffered from cancer. The visit was ultimately scheduled for February 22nd, on which date the officer recorded her observations, stating,
"Went around to the rear yard. Backyard covered in rubbish, right up to doorstep. Matter now considered bad property issue."
The following day, the client service visit did take place, and the officer recorded her observations, noting she was only allowed to see the backyard, kitchen, lounge, and hallway. She was not permitted to view the rest of the property, including the bedrooms. According to official reports,
she observed that the lounge and hallway were cluttered with things and rubbish, and that the kitchen was infested with cockroaches, mice, and spider webs.
The client services officer made a referral to a senior specialist, noting the children's names and ages and her concerns about the condition of the property. Under comments and concerns, the officer wrote,
"Property care needs immediate attention, as the three daughters are living in this uncleanliness. There has been previous DOCS involvement for information concerning children's welfare."
The senior specialist contacted DOCS the next day, noting that she spoke with an intake worker, following which,
"Case closed following inability to gain access. Can't get through on telephone. DOCS closed the case because of this without further investigation."
Another home visit was performed on March 12, 2007, when the senior specialist interviewed Blake in the ward's home. Blake told the woman that DOH officers were not allowed to enter the bedrooms because his wife was recovering from a recent hospitalization. As for the state of the property, the man blamed his kids, saying the girls caused the condition of the home due to their ADHD. The specialist, who reported to DOCS that the home was
in a putrid state,
ordered Blake to clean the property. On March 26, the specialist visited the home again and noted the overall condition of the property had improved, although a window in one of the children's bedrooms was covered with plywood. Blake explained that someone threw a rock, breaking the window, and asked that the
wood stay in place for safety reasons.
The specialist later noted that Blake
does not hold himself or family responsible for the current state of his property.
At this visit, she did not see the children, who Blake said were being homeschooled elsewhere. During a subsequent home visit on April 5th, the senior specialist later reported Blake was aggressive and complained that the DOH had failed to attend to his property for over 2 years. He continued to deny the specialist entry to the bedrooms. Once again, the children were not present for the visit, although the specialist noted that Sharon was home. The couple's three daughters were to be medically assessed, but Blake would not allow them to be seen at the Sydney Children's Hospital due to the facility's involvement with having their fourth child removed. Instead, he told a DOCS caseworker on April 20th, the three girls had appointments at the Prince of Wales Private Hospital the following month. The caseworker confirmed the appointments and was also able to see the two older girls in person. Blake told the caseworker that Shelley was asleep in her room, while her older sister said she was next door. According to Blake, he did not want to wake Shelley because she would be
distressed
to know DOCS officers were present in the home. A few days later, the caseworker met with her supervisor, who later stated that she knew the caseworker had not seen Shelley. Based on the caseworker's description of the two older girls, the supervisor said, she
did not think there would be anything different for Shelley.
At this point, DOCS had been informed that the wards were setting up homeschooling for their children, which was backed up by reports for each of the two older girls from a private psychologist who recommended the girls be homeschooled. However, the psychologist later said his recommendation for the two girls was based on an hour-long interview with each, as well as information provided by Blake, and the doctor was not aware the children had not been attending school for some time. The DET had no record of the wards applying to enroll their children in distance learning or registering them for homeschooling, nor did the Board of Studies. Meanwhile, the DOCS supervisor handed over the management of the ward's case to a new supervisor. So when DOCS received a phone call on the same day from a pediatrician from the Prince of Wales Private Hospital with concerns about her examination of the two older girls, that information somehow missed being provided to a supervisor. Shelley did not attend her appointment at the private hospital, and subsequent appointments for her were cancelled. Between May and August, the DOH client service officer attempted to make several home visits and phone calls to the family, but was unable to contact anyone. By July, the first DOCS caseworker had left the department and transferred the ward's case to a new individual. However, due to a heavy workload, the first caseworker was unable to review the file with the new one. Both caseworkers and supervisors later agreed that the case involving the three ward girls was not considered a high-risk or high-priority case. Also in July, a student welfare consultant, on orders from regional DET officials, made a home visit after a neighbor reported hearing a young child screaming and claimed the mother and children rarely left the house. The consultant reported this information to DOCS and documented contacting the private psychologist who briefly assessed the children and recommended homeschooling due to anxiety, depression, and obsessive-compulsive behavior on the part of the girls. Later that month, another home visit was attempted when a neighbor reported to the DET that someone was home at the ward house. Contact was made with Blake, who said his family was away and that they planned to move to the Central Coast. After this home visit, the DET sent Blake a letter informing him that a meeting had been scheduled for August 3rd. Blake did not attend the meeting. On August 31, 2007, a concerned member of the community saw a moving company or removalist's truck outside the family's Matreville home and notified the DET, which contacted police, requesting their assistance in obtaining the Ward family's forwarding address, which police were unable to obtain. The student welfare consultant attempted another home visit on that date, but once again was not able to contact any member of the family. Subsequently, she recommended the Ward's case be referred to more senior DOCS officials, but there is no evidence in the family's files that this occurred. It was later determined that the student's summary notes in Chalet's case file were inaccurate, misleading, and incomplete, leaving out essential details. Because of this inadequate summary, which was referenced going forward each time an at-risk report was made about the family, DOCS helpline workers failed to realize how grave Chalet's situation truly was. Later, the removalist, who may have been the last person outside of the family to see Chalet alive, recalled being forbidden to enter Chalet's bedroom because, as it was explained to him, she was autistic and would cry and get cranky if she was awakened. He also reported seeing a tiny,
unusually skinny,
girl who appeared to be about 3 years old, lying silent and motionless on the floor of a bedroom in the home, staring at him. By that time, Chalet was 7 years and 5 months old. Meanwhile, Blake and Sharon moved their family to a private rental home at 6 Guya Street in Hawks Nest, New South Wales, a small town just north of Port Stephens, where they would no longer be under the watchful eye of the DOH or DOCS. On September 6th, a senior DET officer contacted the NSW police force, seeking police assistance in locating the family. After the Matreville house was vacated, on September 12th, 2007, concerned neighbor Janice Reed entered the home and reported to the DET that the house was filthy, with knee-deep trash in every room, and in Chalet's room, there was human feces and dirty nappies, or diapers, all over the floor. The bathtub was full of cigarettes. The entire house reeked of urine and feces, and cockroaches had infested the filthy kitchen. In addition, the window of Chalet's room was boarded up. Janice and the DET both reported these concerns to DOCS, but the DOCS helpline categorized these reports as
information only
and did not take action. Although DOCS was tasked with supervising the cleanup of the home almost 6 months before, it seems no follow-up visits took place and no DOCS caseworkers set foot inside the house until after the family moved out. On September 19th, the DOCS caseworker asked the DOH for the family's forwarding address. The address was eventually found on an invoice the moving company provided the DOH. On September 20th, the caseworker went on sick leave for 2 weeks. On October 9th, the co-worker returned from sick leave and did some work on the Ward family's risk assessment. On October 23rd, the caseworker left the department to take another job within the agency. 3 days later, a supervisor completed the risk assessment, and on October 30th, DOCS transferred the Ward's child protection files from its Strawberry Hills location to its office in Raymond Terrace, informing the manager there during a case transfer discussion that Chalet's risk of harm was extreme, no protective factors were in place, and the probability that the little girl would be harmed was
highly likely.
Even so, a caseworker was not immediately assigned to the family, and within days, Chalet was dead. At 1 p.m. on November 3, 2007, Blake Ward made a panicked call to Australia's emergency number, 000, telling the dispatcher a child in his home in Hawks Nest was dead. When NSW ambulance officers Adam Diamond and Timothy Kirkpatrick arrived, Blake waved them toward a bedroom in the small house, saying,
"I can't bear to go in there."
When the bedroom door was opened, an unholy stench rolled out of the room, which was strewn with feces that had piled up in the corners. The only furniture was a mattress on the floor, on which lay the emaciated body of a tiny child who appeared to be about 3 years old. 7-year-old Chalet Ward was so emaciated that her face appeared shrunken, later described as a
skull wrapped in skin.
The room contained no toys or furniture, and its window was boarded over. The single decoration on the wall was a poster print of a painting of a sad child leaning with her head against the wall. Chalet's clothing and bedding were heavily stained with what appeared to be a combination of vomit, feces, and other bodily fluids. There were no sheets on the mattress, There was a towel beneath Shelley's body, and she was partially covered with another towel and a doona, which is basically a duvet or comforter. There was nothing medical staff could do for Shelley, and police were summoned to the home. Besides Shelley's room, the rest of the house appeared fairly normal, except for a few oddities. A rubbish bin was filled with photos of Shelley and also contained a man's shirt and a clump of matted red hair. It also appeared that over time, Shelley no longer appeared in family photos. In March of 2007, the family held a birthday party for Shelley, who wasn't even present. She was in her filthy bedroom with the door tied shut. According to Sharon, that was because
she would be running around like a mini tornado and getting into everything, and she has broken presents.
Investigators asked one of Shelley's teenage sisters, who was playing on the computer, how she was holding up, and the girl replied,
"I had a little cry, but now I'm over it."
Blake, an officer noted, was
detached, robotic, no emotion, very monotone.
When an ambulance officer asked the couple if Shelley had been unwell, Blake told him,
"She was playing last night and everything was okay."
Sharon put in,
"She hasn't coped with the move up from Sydney very well. She had vomiting and diarrhea over the past week and hasn't eaten well since the move from Sydney."
When Sharon was questioned, she told investigators that when she checked on Shelley at 7 o'clock that morning, she found her daughter dead and attempted mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, but stopped due to black vomit and bull ants coming out of Shelley's mouth. When she realized Shelley was truly dead, Sharon sang lullabies to her daughter's body for several hours, not telling a soul in the house what had happened. Blake said he arose sometime after 9 a.m. and immediately got on his computer to place a bet, which he won. He told police he
thought it was going to be a good day,
so he placed another bet and spent considerable time studying the racing guide. When Blake asked one of the kids where Sharon was, he claimed, he was told she was in the bedroom with Shelley. Around 11 a.m., Blake entered the bedroom to find his wife trying to resuscitate their daughter.
Sharon was leaning over, crying. I said, "Hun, what's wrong? Where's Shelley? What's wrong?" And she couldn't talk.
Blake said he returned to the lounge room, and Sharon followed him.
I said, "What's wrong? It's not Shelley, is it?" I knew by the look, and I said, "She's not dead, is she? What's wrong with you? You're kidding?" Sharon just said, "My princess is dead, so what's the use of me living?"
By that time, Sharon had ingested 2 Valium tablets and 20 Panadol tablets, but Blake, nonetheless, provided her with a few more Valium before calling his aunt, screaming,
"She's dead, she's dead!"
He hung up without telling the woman who he was talking about, and only after sitting idly on the couch for 2 hours did Blake finally call 000 around 1 p.m. As soon as the media caught wind of the emaciated little dead girl, the house teemed with television crews, and Sharon bolted from the house, threatening to harm herself. She was subsequently hospitalized for treatment of an intentional drug overdose. Blake, however, was glad to sit in front of the cameras and pipe up. Author Anne Mann described him in an article published in The Monthly as follows.
"He has a pudgy face, a long, bleached ponytail, and a strange, inward-looking gaze."
Across the fingers of one hand, Blake sported tattooed letters spelling the word evil. The other hand bore the word dead. One commenter on Web Sleuths summed it up beautifully.
"He looks like Riff Raff from the Rocky Horror Show."
When asked about how Shelley starved to death, Blake said,
"Starvation? We didn't starve her. She was born small. She was a tiny kid."
Blake told reporters,
"I don't know how this can be. She'd eat like anything."
The night before her death, Blake said, Shelley was talkative as she sat with the rest of the family on the couch watching television before she went to bed at about 8 p.m. He and Sharon, Blake insisted, lived for their 3 children.
"I love my kids to death, all 3 of them, and now one of them is gone."
He didn't mention the couple's 4th child, who had long before been taken away from them. After Shelley's death, her older sisters, at the time aged 15 and 13, were taken into DOCS care. The Sydney Morning Herald reported that the girl's grandparents, Walt and Shirley Ward, refused to comment and even posted a guard at the door of their flat in South Coogee. One of their neighbors, Carmen Flanagan, said she only ever saw the 2 older girls, who seemed
very, very healthy,
visit their grandparents. She had never seen Shelley. Right from the beginning, Blake worked hard to deflect blame, saying Shelley's death was DOCS's fault because they didn't check in with the family after their move to Hawk's Nest.
"Now they are claiming I didn't want anyone to see Shelley because she was sick. I don't know. It's all wrong. Life's not fair. They're disgusting. They should be shut down."
Another major factor in Shelley's death, Blake claimed, was the removalist, or moving man, who he said refused to bring Shelley's toys in the move. After that, Blake said, Shelley became depressed and refused to eat. Other than that, Blake insisted, he had no idea how this could have happened to Shelley, begging police,
"Someone help me find out what happened to my little girl."
When interviewed by police on November 5th, Blake said that before he left the house on Friday, November 2nd, he saw Shelley eat breakfast and drink some milk or juice, at which time she seemed physically well. She seemed equally healthy when he returned home that afternoon. Since the move to Hawk's Nest, he said, Shelley seemed less happy than she was before, and her eating habits changed. She was still drinking
a stack of fluids
and eating
a lot of big breakfasts,
but very little for lunch or dinner. He insisted that during her last few days, Shelley seemed bubbly and happy and smiled frequently. A few days later, when Sharon was interviewed, she told police her daughter's formerly huge appetite had decreased since the family's move to Hawk's Nest, but Shelley hadn't been sick, and she figured the little girl was confused by her new surroundings. When asked whether Sharon noticed Shelley becoming frail, the woman replied,
"No, well, she was still walking around. She was still making a sound. She was still gesturing as to what she needed. She was still getting up, going to the fridge. She was still eating. She was still drinking. She was still doing everything she was doing before, and everything, but not to the extent that she would normally do."
Soon after Shelley's death, NSW Premier Morris Iemma told the media,
"I find it difficult to come to terms with a child starving to death in our community. We're a modern, prosperous state. I know there are pockets of severe disadvantage, but I shake my head that a child dies, allegedly, through starvation."
Ombudsman Bruce Barber was tasked immediately with investigating Shelley's case.
"We will pursue all necessary avenues of inquiry to ensure a thorough and proper examination of the circumstances leading to the tragic death of this child."
Opposition Community Services spokeswoman Katrina Hodgkinson told the Sydney Morning Herald that on average, a child known to DOCS died every 3 days, which she said indicated systemic failures.
"Since 2003, 440 children known to DOCS have died in circumstances of neglect or abuse, or in suspicious circumstances. And every year, the NSW Ombudsman has urged improvements. Yet the number of children who die following child protection reports being made about them to DOCS is continuing to increase."
In next week's episode, I'll discuss the results of Shelley's autopsy, the findings of multiple investigations into her death, her parents' arrests and trial, and the utter system failure that led to the death of the adorable, red-haired autistic girl who would come to be known across Australia only as Ebony. My sources for this episode were Find a Grave, a 2009 report by NSW Ombudsman Bruce Barber, titled
"The Death of Ebony, The Need for an Effective Interagency Response to Children at Risk,"
an article in The Monthly by Anne Mann, titled
"Ebony,
The Daily Telegraph, The Sydney Morning Herald, news.com.au, New South Wales Case Law, Criminal Justice on iResearchNet, ABC News Australia, The Newcastle Herald, Web Sleuths, an article titled
"Guilty Until Proven Innocent, The Assumption of Care of a Baby at Birth"
by Christine A. Marsh, Jenny Brown, Jan Taylor, and Deborah Davis, childwelfare.gov, and court documents. That's it for this week. Join me next week for part two of Shelley's story. If you like the show, please follow or subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Spotify, Spreaker, Pandora, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. And please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. Visit the website at sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes or become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to bonus content and exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter and TikTok at STLCPod. View photos related to today's episode on Facebook and Instagram. For more stories like the one you heard today, visit sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast is researched, written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. All music for the show is licensed from audiojungle.net. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. For more information about preventing or reporting child abuse, visit childhelp.org or call your area's child abuse hotline. If you see something, say something. Until next week, bye everyone.